He flipped the page. Here's Vedanar, capital of Yakoved. This one was a hexagonal pattern. Akina, a circular pattern. Thalen City, a four-pointed star pattern. What does it mean? It is proof that the Almighty is in all things. You can see him here in these cities. Do you see how symmetrical they are?
The cities were built by men, Capsule. They wanted symmetry because it is holy.
Yes, but in each case they built around existing rock formations.
That doesn't mean anything, Shallan said. I do believe, but I don't know if this is proof. Wind and water can create symmetry. You see it in nature all the time. The men picked areas that were roughly symmetrical, then designed their cities to make up for any flaws.
He turned to his basket again, rummaging. He came out with, of all things, a metal plate. As she opened her mouth to ask a question, he held up his finger again and set the plate down on a small wooden stand that raised it a few inches above the tabletop. Capsule sprinkled white powdery sand on the sheet of metal, coating it. Then he got out a bow, the kind drawn across strings to make music.
You came prepared for this demonstration, I see, Shallan noted. You really did want to make your case to Yasna.
He smiled, then drew the bow across the edge of the metal plate, making it vibrate. The sand hopped and bounced, like tiny insects dropped onto something hot. This, he said, is called cymatics. The study of the patterns that sounds make when interacting with a physical medium. As he drew the bow again, the plate made a sound, almost a pure note. It was actually enough to draw a single music spren, which spun for a moment in the air above him, then vanished. Capsule finished, then gestured to the plate with a flourish.
So?
Shallan asked. Kolinar, he said, holding up his book for comparison. Shallan cocked her head. The pattern in the sand looked exactly like Kolinar. He dropped more sand on the plate and then drew the bow across it at another point, and the sand rearranged itself. Vedanar, he said. She compared again. It was an exact match. Thalen City, he said, repeating the process at another spot. He carefully chose another point on the plate's edge and bowed it one final time. Akina. Shallan, proof of the Almighty's existence is in the very cities we live in. Look at the perfect symmetry. She had to admit there was something compelling about the patterns.
It could be a false correlation, both caused by the same thing.
Yes, the Almighty, he said, sitting. Our very language is symmetrical. Look at the glyphs. Each one can be folded in half perfectly. And the alphabet, too. Fold any line of text down across itself and you'll find symmetry. Surely you know the story, that both glyphs and letters came from the Dawn Singers?
Yes.
Even our names. Yours is nearly perfect. Shallan. One letter off, an ideal name for a light-eyed woman. Not too holy, but ever so close. The original names for the 10 Silver Kingdoms. Alethela. Valav, Shinkoknish, perfect, symmetrical.
He reached forward, taking her hand.
It's here, around us. Don't forget that, Shallan, no matter what she says.
I won't, she said, realizing how he'd guided the conversation. He'd said he believed her, but still he'd gone through his proofs. It was touching and annoying at the same time. She did not like condescension. But then, could one really blame an Ardent for preaching?
Capsule looked up suddenly, releasing her hand. I hear footsteps.
He stood, and Shallan turned as Yasna walked into the alcove, followed by a parchman carrying a basket of books. Yasna showed no surprise at the presence of the Ardent.
I'm sorry, Brightness Yasna, Shallan said, standing.
He... You're not a captive, child, Yasna interrupted brusquely. You are allowed visitors. Just be careful to check your skin for tooth marks. These types have a habit of dragging their prey out to sea with them.
Capsule flushed. He moved to gather up his things.
Yasna waited for the parchment to place her books on the table.
Can that plate reproduce a cymatic pattern corresponding to Urethiru, priest? Or do you only have patterns for the standard four cities?
Capsule looked at her, obviously shocked to realize that she knew exactly what the plate was for. He picked up his book.
Urethiru is just a fable.
Odd. One would think that your type would be used to believing in fables.
His face grew redder. He finished packing his things, then nodded curtly to Shallan and walked hastily from the room.
If I may say so, Brightness, Shallan said, that was exceptionally rude of you.
I'm prone to such bouts of incivility, Yasna said. I'm certain he has heard what I'm like. I simply wanted to make sure he got what he expected.
You haven't acted that way toward other Ardents in the Palinaeum.
The other Ardents in the Palinaeum haven't been working to turn my ward against me.
He wasn't... Shallan trailed off. He was simply worried about my soul.
Has he asked you to try to steal my soul caster yet?
Shallan felt a sudden spike of shock. Her hand went to the pouch at her waist.
Did Yasna know?
No, Shallan told herself. No, listen to the question.
He didn't.
Watch, Yasna said, opening a book. He will eventually. I've experience with his type.
She looked at Shallan and her expression softened.
He's not interested in you.
Not in any of the ways you think.
In particular, this isn't about your soul. It's about me.
That is somewhat arrogant of you, Shallan said. Don't you think?
Only if I'm wrong, child, Yasna said, turning back to her book. And I rarely am.
Thirty-four. Stormwall. I walked from Abamabar to Urethiru. This quote from the eighth parable of the Way of Kings seems to contradict Varla and Sinbian, who both claim the city was inaccessible by foot. Perhaps there was a way constructed, or perhaps Noadan was being metaphorical. Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive. Kaladin's mind felt fuzzy. He knew that he hurt, but other than that, he floated. As if his head were detached from his body, and bouncing off the walls and ceilings.
Kaladin?
A concerned voice whispered.
Kaladin, please. Please don't be hurt anymore.
Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive. Why did those words bother him so much? He remembered what had happened, using the bridge as a shield, throwing the army off, dooming the assault.
Stormfather, he thought. I'm an idiot. Kaladin?
It was Syl's voice. He risked opening his eyes and looked out on an upside-down world, sky extending below him, familiar lumberyard in the air above him. No. He was upside down. Hanging from the side of Bridge Four's barrack, the soulcast building was 15 feet tall at its peak, with a shallowly slanted roof. Kaladin was tied by his ankles to a rope, which would, in turn, be affixed to a ring set into the slanted roof. He'd seen it happen to other bridgemen. One who had committed a murder in camp, another who had been caught stealing for the fifth time. His back was to the wall so that he faced eastward. His arms were free, hanging down at his sides, and they almost touched the ground. He groaned again, hurting everywhere. As his father had trained him, he began to prod his side to check for broken ribs. He winced as he found several that were tender, at least cracked. Probably broken. He felt at his shoulder, too, where he feared that his collarbone was broken. One of his eyes was swollen. Time would show if he'd sustained any serious internal damage. He rubbed his face, and flakes of dried blood cracked free and fluttered toward the ground. Gash on his head, bloodied nose, split lip. Syl landed on his chest, feet planted on his sternum, hands clasped before her.
Kaladin?
I'm alive, he mumbled, words slurred by his swollen lip. What happened?
You were beaten by those soldiers, she said, seeming to grow smaller. I've gotten back at them. I made one of them trip 3 times today.
She looked concerned. He found himself smiling. How long could a man hang like this, blood going to his head?
There was a lot of yelling, Syl said softly. I think several men were demoted. The soldier Lamoral, he...
What?
He was executed,
Syl said, even more quietly.
High Prince Sadius did it himself, the hour the army got back from the plateau. He said something about the ultimate responsibility falling on the Light Eyes. Lamoral kept screaming that you had promised to absolve him, and that Gaz should be punished instead.
Kaladin smirked ruefully. He shouldn't have had me beaten senseless. Gaz?
They left him in his position. I don't know why.
Right of responsibility. In a disaster like this, the Light Eyes are supposed to take most of the blame. They like to make a show of obeying old precepts like that when it suits them. Why am I still alive?
Something about an example,
Syl said, wrapping her translucent arms around herself.
Kaladin, I feel cold.
You can feel temperature, Kaladin said, coughing.
Not usually. I can now. I don't understand it. I don't like it.
It'll be all right.
You shouldn't lie.
Sometimes it's all right to lie, Syl.
And this is one of those times?
He blinked, trying to ignore his wounds, the pressure in his head, trying to clear his mind. He failed on all counts. Yes, he whispered.
I think I understand.
So, Kaladin said, resting his head back, the parietal knob of his skull resting against the wall. I'm to be judged by the High Storm. They'll let the storm kill me. Hanging here, Kaladin would be exposed directly to the winds and everything they would throw at him. If you were prudent and took appropriate action, it was possible to survive outside in a high storm, though it was a miserable experience. Kaladin had done it on several occasions, hunkered down, taking shelter in the lee of a rock formation. But hanging on a wall facing directly stormward, he'd be cut to ribbons and crushed by stones.
I'll be right back,
Syl said, dropping off his chest, taking the form of a falling stone, then changing into wind-blown leaves near the ground, and fluttering away, curving to the right. The lumberyard was empty. Kaladin could smell the crisp, chill air, the land bracing for a high storm. The lull, it was called. When the wind fell still, the air cold, the pressure dropping, the humidity rising right before a storm. A few seconds later, Rock poked his head around the wall, Syl on his shoulder. He crept up to Kaladin, a nervous Teft following. They were joined by Moash. Despite the latter's protests that he didn't trust Kaladin, he looked almost as concerned as the other two. Lordling, Moash said. You awake? I'm conscious, Kaladin croaked. Everyone get back from the battle all right? All of our men, sure enough, Teft said, scratching at his beard. But we lost the battle. It was a disaster. Over 200 bridgemen dead. Those who survived were only enough to carry 11 bridges. 200 men, Kaladin thought. That's my fault. I protected my own at the cost of others. I was too hasty. Bridgemen aren't supposed to survive. There's something about that. He wouldn't be able to ask Lamoral. That man had gotten what he deserved, though. If Kaladin had the ability to choose, such would be the end of all Light Eyes, the king included. We want to say something, Rock said. It's from all of the men. Most wouldn't come out. High storm coming and... It's all right, Kaladin whispered. Teft nudged Rock to continue.
Well, is this. We will remember you. Bridge 4. We won't go back to how we were. Maybe all of us will die, but we'll show the new ones. Fires at night, laughter, living. We'll make a tradition out of it. For you.
Rock and Teft knew about the knobweed. They could keep earning extra money to pay for things.
You did this for us, Moash put in. We'd have died on that field. Perhaps as many as died in the other bridge crews. And this way we're only going to lose one.
I say it isn't right, what they're doing, Teft said with a scowl.
We talked about cutting you down.
No, Kaladin said. That would only earn you a similar punishment. The three men shared glances. It seemed they'd come to the same conclusion.
What did Sadius say, Kaladin asked, about me?
That he understood how a bridgeman would want to save his life, Teft said, even at others' expense. He called you a selfish coward, but acted like that was all that could be expected. He says he's letting the Stormfather judge you, Moash added. Yzeriza, King of Heralds. He says that if you deserve to live, you will.
He trailed off. He knew as well as the others that unprotected men didn't survive high storms. Not like this.
I want you three to do something for me, Kaladin said, closing his eyes against the blood trickling down his face from his lip, which he'd cracked open by speaking.
Anything, Kaladin, Rock said.
I want you to go back into the barrack and tell the men to come out after the storm. Tell them to look up at me tied here. Tell them I'll open my eyes and look back at them. And they'll know that I survived.
The three bridgemen fell silent.
Yes, of course, Kaladin, Teft said. We'll do it.
Tell them, Kaladin continued, voice firmer, that it won't end here. Tell them I chose not to take my own life, and so there's no way in damnation I'm going to give it up to Sadius.
Rock smiled one of those broad smiles of his.
By the Uli Takanaki, Kaladin, I almost believe you'll do it.
Here, Teft said, handing him something. For luck.
Kaladin took the object in a weak, blood-stained hand. It was a sphere, a full sky mark. It was done, the stormlight gone from it. Carry a sphere with you into the storm, the old saying said, and at least you'll have light by which to see.
It's all we were able to save from your pouch, Teft said. Gaz and Lamoral got the rest. We complained, but what were we to do?
Thank you, Kaladin said.
Moash and Rock retreated to the safety of the barrack, still leaving Rock's shoulder to stay with Kaladin. Teft lingered too, as if thinking to spend the storm with Kaladin. He eventually shook his head, muttering, and joined the others. Kaladin thought he heard the man calling himself a coward. The door to the barrack shut. Kaladin fingered the smooth glass sphere. The sky was darkening, and not just because the sun was setting. Blackness gathered. The high storm. Syl walked up the side of the wall, then sat down on it, looking at him, tiny face somber.
You told them you'd survive. What happens if you don't?
Kaladin's head was pounding with his pulse.
My mother would cringe if she knew how quickly the other soldiers taught me to gamble. First night in Amaram's army, and they had me playing for spheres.
Kaladin?
Syl said.
Sorry,
Kaladin said, rocking his head from side to side.
What you said, it reminded me of that night. There's a term in gambling, you see. In for all, they say. It's when you put all of your money on one bet.
I don't understand.
I'm putting it all on the long bet, Kaladin whispered. If I die, then they'll come out, shake their heads, and tell themselves they knew it would happen. But if I live, they'll remember it, and it will give them hope. They might see it as a miracle.
Syl was silent for a moment.
Do you want to be a miracle?
No, Kaladin whispered. But for them I will be. It was a desperate, foolish hope. The eastern horizon, inverted in his sight, was growing darker. From this perspective, the storm was like the shadow of some enormous beast lumbering across the ground. He felt the disturbing fuzziness of a person who had been hit too hard on the head. Concussion. That was what it was called. He was having trouble thinking, but he didn't want to fall unconscious. He wanted to stare at the high storm straight on, though it terrified him. He felt the same panic he'd felt looking down into the black chasm back when he'd nearly killed himself. It was the fear of what he could not see, what he could not know. The storm wall approached, the visible curtain of rain and wind at the advent of a high storm. It was a massive wave of water, dirt, and rocks, hundreds of feet high, thousands upon thousands of windsprens zipping before it. In battle, he'd been able to fight his way to safety with the skill of his spear. When he'd stepped to the edge of the chasm, there had been a line of retreat. This time, there was nothing. No way to fight or avoid that black beast, that shadow spanning the entirety of the horizon, plunging the world into an early night. The eastern edge of the crater that made the war camp had been torn away, and Bridge Four's barrack was first in its row. There was nothing between him and the plains, nothing between him and the storm. Staring at that raging, blustering, churning wave of wind-pushed water and debris, Kaladin felt as if he were watching the end of the world descend upon him. He took a deep breath, the pain of his ribs forgotten, as the storm wall crossed the lumberyard in a flash and slammed into him. A light by which to see. Though many wished Urethiru to be built in Alethela, it was obvious that it could not be. And so it was that we asked for it to be placed westward, in the place nearest to Honor. Perhaps the oldest surviving original source mentioning the city, requoted in the Vavibrar, line 1804. What I wouldn't give for a way to translate the dawn chant. The force of the storm wall nearly knocked him unconscious, but the sudden chill of it shocked him lucid. For a moment, Kaladin couldn't feel anything but that coldness. He was pressed against the side of the barrack by the extended blast of water. Rocks and bits of branch crashed against the stone around him. He was already too numb to tell how many slashed or beat against his skin. He bore it, dazed, eyes pressed shut and breath held. Then the storm wall passed, crashing onward. The next blast of wind came in from the side. The air was swirling and gusting from all directions now. The wind flung him sideways, his back scraping against the stone, and up into the air. The wind stabilized, blowing out of the east again. Kaladin hung in darkness, and his feet yanked against the rope. In a panic, he realized that he was now flapping in the wind like a kite, tied to the ring in the barrack's slanted roof. Only that rope kept him from being blown along with the other debris to be tumbled and tossed before the storm across the entirety of Roshar. For those few heartbeats, he could not think. He could only feel the panic and the cold, one boiling out of his chest, the other trying to freeze him from the skin inward. He screamed, clutching his single sphere as if it were a lifeline. The scream was a mistake as it let that coldness course into his mouth, like a spirit forcing its arm down his throat. The wind was like a maelstrom, chaotic, moving in different directions. One buffet ripped at him, then passed, and he fell to the roof of the barrack with a thud. Almost immediately, the terrible winds tried to lift him again, pounding his skin with waves of icy water. Thunder crashed, the heartbeat of the beast that had swallowed him. Lightning split the darkness like white teeth in the night. The wind was so loud it nearly drowned out the thunder, howling and moaning.
"Grab the roof, Kaladin,"
Syl's voice, so soft, so small. How could he hear it at all? Numbly, he realized he was lying face down on the sloped roof. It wasn't so steeply peaked that he was immediately pitched off, and the wind was generally blowing him backward. He did as Syl said, grabbing the lip of the roof with cold, slick fingers. Then he lay face down, head tucked between his arms. He still had the sphere in his hand, pressed against the stone rooftop. His fingers started to slip. The wind was blowing so hard, trying to push him to the west. If he let go, he'd end up dangling in the air again. His rope tether was not long enough for him to get to the other side of the shallow, peaked rooftop, where he'd be sheltered. A boulder hit the roof beside him. He couldn't hear its impact or see it in the tempest's darkness, but he could feel the building vibrate. The boulder rolled forward and crashed to the ground. The entire storm didn't have such force, but occasional gusts could pick up and toss large objects, hurling them hundreds of feet. His fingers slipped further.
"The ring,"
Syl whispered. "The ring." The rope tied his legs to a steel ring on the side of the roof behind him. Kaladin let go, then snatched the ring as he was blown backward. He clutched to it. The rope continued down to his ankles, about the length of his body. He thought for a moment of untying the ropes, but he didn't dare let go of the ring. He clung there, like a pennant, flapping in the wind, holding the ring in both hands, sphere cupped inside one of them, and pressed against the steel. Each moment was a struggle. The wind yanked him left, then hurled him right. He couldn't know how long it lasted. Time had no meaning in this place of fury and tumult. His numbed, battered mind started to think he was in a nightmare, a terrible dream inside his head, full of black, living winds. Screams in the air, bright and white, the flash of lightning revealing a terrible, twisted world of chaos and terror. The very buildings seemed blown sideways, the entire world askew, warped by the storm's terrible power. In those brief moments of light when he dared to look, he thought he saw Syl standing in front of him, her face to the wind, tiny hands forward, as if she were trying to hold back the storm and split the winds as a stone divided the waters of a swift stream. The cold of the rainwater numbed the scrapes and bruises, but it also numbed his fingers. He didn't feel them slipping. The next he knew, he was whipping in the air again, tossed to the side, being slammed down against the roof of the barrack. He hit hard. His vision flashed with sparkling lights that melted together and were followed by blackness. Not unconsciousness, blackness. Kaladin blinked. All was still. The storm was quiet and everything was purely dark. "I'm dead," he thought immediately. But why could he feel the wet stone roof beneath him? He shook his head, dripping rainwater down his face. There was no lightning, no wind, no rain. The silence was unnatural. He stumbled to his feet, managing to stand on the gently sloped roof. The stone was slick beneath his toes. He couldn't feel his wounds. The pain just wasn't there. He opened his mouth to call out into the darkness, but hesitated. That silence was not to be broken. The air itself seemed to weigh less, as did he. He almost felt as if he could float away. In that darkness, an enormous face appeared just in front of his. A face of blackness, yet faintly traced in the dark. It was wide, the breadth of a massive thunderhead, and extended far to either side. Yet it was somehow still visible to Kaladin. Inhuman? Smiling. Kaladin felt a deep chill. A rolling prickle of ice scurried down his spine and through his entire body. The sphere suddenly burst to life in his hand, flaring with a sapphire glow. It illuminated the stone roof beneath him, making his fist blaze with blue fire. His shirt was in tatters, his skin lacerated. He looked down at himself, shocked, then looked up at the face. It was gone. There was only the darkness. Lightning flashed and Kaladin's pains returned. He gasped, falling to his knees before the rain and the wind. He slipped down, face hitting the rooftop. What had that been? A vision? A delusion? His strength was fleeing him, his thoughts growing muddled again. The winds weren't as strong now, but the rain was still so cold. Lethargic, confused, nearly overwhelmed by his pain, he brought his hand up to the side and looked at the sphere. It was glowing, smeared with his blood, and glowing. He hurt so much, and his strength had faded. Closing his eyes, he felt himself enveloped by a second blackness. The blackness of unconsciousness. Rock was the first to the door when the high storm subsided. Teft followed more slowly, groaning to himself. His knees hurt. His knees always hurt near a storm. His grandfather had complained about that in his later years, and Teft had called him daft. Now he felt it too. Storming damnation, he thought, wearily stepping outside. It was still raining, of course. These were the afterflurries of drizzle that trailed a high storm, the riddens. A few rain-spren sat in puddles, like blue candles, and a few wind-spren danced in the storm winds. The rain was cold, and he splashed through puddles that soaked his sandaled feet, chilling them straight through the skin and muscle. He hated being wet, but then he hated a lot of things. For a while, life had been looking up. Not now. How did everything go so wrong so quickly, he thought, holding his arms close, walking slowly and watching his feet. Some soldiers had left their barracks and stood nearby, wearing rain cloaks, watching. Probably to make certain nobody had snuck out to cut Kaladin down early. They didn't try to stop Rock, though. The storm had passed. Rock charged around the side of the building. Other bridgemen left the barrack behind as Teft followed Rock. Storming Horneater, like a big lumbering chull. He actually believed. He thought they'd find that foolish young bridge leader alive. Probably figured they'd discover him having a nice cup of tea, relaxing in the shade with the Stormfather himself. "And you don't believe?" Teft asked himself, still looking down. "If you don't, why are you following? But if you did believe, you'd look. You wouldn't stare at your feet. You'd look up and see." Could a man both believe and not believe at the same time? Teft stopped beside Rock and, steeling himself, looked up at the wall of the barrack. There he saw what he'd expected and what he'd feared. The corpse looked like a hunk of slaughterhouse meat, skinned and bled. Was that a person? Kaladin's skin was sliced in 100 places, dribbles of blood mixing with rainwater running down the side of the building. The lad's body still hung by the ankles. His shirt had been ripped off. His bridgeman trousers were ragged. Ironically, his face was cleaner now than when they'd left him, washed by the storm. Teft had seen enough dead men on the battlefield to know what he was looking at. "Poor lad," he thought, shaking his head as the rest of Bridge Four gathered around him in Rock, quiet, horrified. "You almost made me believe in you." Kaladin's eyes snapped open. The gathered bridgemen gasped, several cursing and falling to the ground, splashing in the pools of rainwater. Kaladin drew in a ragged breath, wheezing, eyes staring forward, intense and unseeing. He exhaled, blowing flecks of bloody spittle out over his lips. His hand, hanging below him, slipped open. Something dropped to the stones. The sphere Teft had given him. It splashed into a puddle and stopped there. It was done. No stormlight in it. "What in the name of Kalek?" Teft thought, kneeling. "You left a sphere out in the storm and it gathered stormlight. Held in Kaladin's hand, this one should have been fully infused. What had gone wrong?"
"Umalakaki!"
Rock bellowed, pointing.
"Kamamohare namavao!"
He stopped, realizing he was speaking the wrong language.
"Somebody be helping me get him down. He's still alive. We need ladder and knife. Hurry!"
The bridgemen scrambled. The soldiers approached, muttering, but they didn't stop the bridgemen. Sadeus himself had declared that the Stormfather would choose Kaladin's fate. Everyone knew that meant death. Except... Teft stood up straight, holding the dun sphere. "An empty sphere after a storm," he thought. "And a man who's still alive when he should be dead. Two impossibilities." Together they bespoke something that should be even more impossible.
Where's that ladder? Teft found himself yelling. Curse you all, hurry! Hurry! We need to get him bandaged. Somebody go fetch that savvy always puts on wounds.
He glanced back at Kaladin, then spoke much more softly.
And you'd better survive, son, because I want some answers.
The Lesson. Taking the Dawn Shard, known to bind any creature voidish or mortal, he crawled up the steps, crafted for heralds, 10 strides tall apiece, toward the grand temple above. From the poem of Ista, I have found no modern explanation of what these Dawn Shards are. They seem ignored by scholars, though talk of them was obviously prevalent among those recording the early mythologies. It was not uncommon for us to meet native peoples while traveling through the unclaimed hills, Shallan read. These ancient lands were once one of the Silver Kingdoms, after all. One must wonder if the great-shelled beasts lived among them back then, or if the creatures have come to inhabit the wilderness left by humankind's passing. She settled back in her chair, the humid air warm around her. To her left, Yasna Kolin floated quietly in the pool, inset in the floor of the bathing chamber. Yasna liked to soak in the bath, and Shallan couldn't blame her. During most of Shallan's life, bathing had been an ordeal, involving dozens of parshmen carting heated buckets of water, followed by a quick scrub in the brass tub before the water cooled. Karbranth's palace offered far more luxury. The stone pool in the ground resembled a small personal lake, luxuriously warmed by clever fabrials that produced heat. Shallan didn't know much about fabrials yet, though part of her was very intrigued. This type was becoming increasingly common. Just the other day, the conclave staff had sent Yasna one to heat her chambers. The water didn't have to be carried in, but came out of pipes. At the turn of a lever, water flowed in. It was warm when it entered, and was kept heated by the fabrials set into the sides of the pool. Shallan had bathed in the chamber herself, and it was absolutely marvelous. The practical decor was of rock, decorated with small, colorful stones, set in mortar up the sides of the walls. Shallan sat beside the pool, fully dressed, reading as she waited on Yasna's needs. The book was Gavilar's account, as spoken to Yasna herself years ago, after his first meeting with the strange parshman later known as the Parshendi. Occasionally, during our explorations, we'd meet with natives, she read. Not parshmen. Natan people, with their pale bluish skin, wide noses, and wool-like white hair. In exchange for gifts of food, they would point us to the hunting grounds of Great Shells. Then we met the parshmen. I'd been on a half-dozen expeditions to Natanatan, but never had I seen anything like this. Parshmen living on their own? All logic, experience, and science declared that to be an impossibility. Parshmen need the hand of civilized peoples to guide them. This has been proven time and time again. Leave one out in the wilderness and it will just sit there doing nothing until someone comes along to give it orders. Yet here was a group who could hunt, make weapons, build buildings, and indeed create their own civilization. We soon realized that this single discovery could expand, perhaps overthrow, all we understood about our gentle servants. Shallan moved her eyes down to the bottom of the page, where, separated by a line, the undertext was written in a small, cramped script. Most books dictated by men had an undertext, notes added by the woman or ardent who scribed the book. By unspoken agreement, the undertext was never shared out loud. Here, a wife would sometimes clarify, or even contradict, the account of her husband. The only way to preserve such honesty for future scholars was to maintain the sanctity and secrecy of the writing. It should be noted, Yasna had written in the undertext to this passage, that I have adapted my father's words, by his own instruction, to make them more appropriate for recording. That meant she made his dictation sound more scholarly and impressive. In addition, by most accounts, King Gavilar originally ignored these strange, self-sufficient parshmen. It was only after explanation by his scholars and scribes that he understood the import of what he'd discovered. This inclusion is not meant to highlight my father's ignorance. He was and is a warrior. His attention was not on the anthropological import of our expedition, but upon the hunt that was to be its culmination. Shallan closed the cover, thoughtful. The volume was from Yasna's own collection. The Palinaeum had several copies, but Shallan wasn't allowed to bring the Palinaeum's books into a bathing chamber. Yasna's clothing lay on a bench at the side of the room. Atop the folded garments, a small golden pouch held the soulcaster. Shallan glanced at Yasna. The princess floated face up in the pool, black hair fanning out behind her in the water, her eyes closed. Her daily bath was the one time she seemed to relax completely. She looked much younger now, stripped of both clothing and intensity, floating like a child resting after a day of active swimming. 34 years old. That seemed ancient in some regards. Some women Yasna's age had children as old as Shallan, and yet it was also young. Young enough that Yasna was praised for her beauty, young enough that men declared it a shame she wasn't yet married. Shallan glanced at the pile of clothing. She carried the broken fabrials in her safe pouch. She could swap them here and now. It was the opportunity she'd been waiting for. Yasna now trusted her enough to relax, soaking in the bathing chamber without worrying about her fabrial. Could Shallan really do it? Could she betray this woman who had taken her in? Considering what I've done before, she thought, this is nothing. It wouldn't be the first time she betrayed someone who trusted her. She stood up. To the side, Yasna cracked an eye. Blast, Shallan thought, tucking the book under her arm, pacing, trying to look thoughtful. Yasna watched her. Not suspiciously. Curiously. Why did your father want to make a treaty with the Parshendi? Shallan found herself asking as she walked. Why wouldn't he want to? That's not an answer. Of course it is. It's just not one that tells you anything. It would help, Brightness, if you would give me a useful answer, then ask a useful question. Shallan set her jaw. What did the Parshendi have that King Gavilar wanted? Yasna smiled, closing her eyes again. Closer, but you can probably guess the answer to that. Shards. Yasna nodded, still relaxed in the water. The text doesn't mention them, Shallan said. My father didn't speak of them, Yasna said, but from things he said, well, I now suspect that they motivated the treaty. Can you be sure he knew, though? Maybe he just wanted the gem hearts. Perhaps, Yasna said. The Parshendi seemed amused at our interest in the gemstones woven into their beards. She smiled. You should have seen our shock when we discovered where they'd gotten them. When the Lancerin died off during the scouring of Aemia, we thought we'd seen the last gem hearts of large size. And yet here was another great-shelled beast with them, living in a land not too distant from Kolinar itself. Anyway, the Parshendi were willing to share them with us, so long as they could still hunt them too. To them, if you took the trouble to hunt the chasm fiends, their gem hearts were yours. I doubt a treaty would have been needed for that. And yet, just before leaving to return to Alethkar, my father suddenly began talking fervently of the need for an agreement. So what happened? What changed? I can't be certain. However, he once described the strange actions of a Parshendi warrior during a chasm fiend hunt. Instead of reaching for his spear when the great shell appeared, this man held his hand to the side in a very suspicious way. Only my father saw it. I suspected he believed the man planned to summon a blade. The Parshendi realized what he was doing and stopped himself. My father didn't speak of it further, and I assume he didn't want the world's eyes on the shattered plains any more than they already were. Shallan tapped her book. It seems tenuous. If he was sure about the blades, he must have seen more. I suspect so as well. But I studied the treaty carefully after his death. The clauses for favored trade status and mutual border crossing could very well have been a step toward folding the Parshendi into Alethkar as a nation. It certainly would have prevented the Parshendi from trading their shards to other kingdoms without coming to us first. Perhaps that was all he wanted to do. But why kill him? Shallan said, arms crossed, strolling in the direction of Yasna's folded clothing. Did the Parshendi realize that he intended to have their shard blades, and so struck at him preemptively? Uncertain, Yasna said. She sounded skeptical. Why did she think the Parshendi killed Gavilar? Shallan nearly asked, but she had a feeling she wouldn't get any more out of Yasna. The woman expected Shallan to think, discover, and draw conclusions on her own. Shallan stopped beside the bench. The pouch holding the soul caster was open, the drawstrings loose. She could see the precious artifact curled up inside. The swap would be easy. She had used a large chunk of her money to buy gemstones that matched Yasna's, and had put them into the broken soul caster. The two were now exactly identical. She still hadn't learned anything about using the fabrial. She'd tried to find a way to ask, but Yasna avoided speaking of the soul caster. Pushing harder would be suspicious. Shallan would have to get information elsewhere. Perhaps from Capsule, or maybe from a book in the Palinaeum. Regardless, the time was upon her. Shallan found her hand going to her safe pouch, and she felt inside of it, running her fingers along the chains of her broken fabrial. Her heart beat faster. She glanced at Yasna, but the woman was just lying there, floating, eyes closed. What if she opened her eyes? Don't think of that, Shallan told herself. Just do it. Make the swap. It's so close. You are progressing more quickly than I had assumed you would, Yasna said suddenly. Shallan spun, but Yasna's eyes were still closed. I was wrong to judge you so harshly because of your prior education. I myself have often said that passion outperforms upbringing. You have the determination and the capacity to become a respected scholar, Shallan. I realize that the answers seem slow in coming, but continue your research. You will have them eventually. Shallan stood for a moment, hand in her pouch, heart thumping uncontrollably. She felt sick. I can't do it, she realized. Storm, Father, but I'm a fool. I came all of this way, and now I can't do it. She pulled her hand from her pouch and stalked back across the bathing chamber to her chair. What was she going to tell her brothers? Had she just doomed her family? She sat down, setting her book aside and sighing, prompting Yasna to open her eyes. Yasna watched her, then righted herself in the water and gestured for the hair soap. Gritting her teeth, Shallan stood up and fetched the soap tray for Yasna, bringing it over and squatting down to proffer it. Yasna took the powdery hair soap and mashed it in her hand, lathering it before putting it into her sleek black hair with both hands. Even naked, Yasna Kolin was composed and in control. Perhaps we have spent too much time indoors of late, the princess said. You look penned up, Shallan. Anxious.
I'm fine, Shallan said brusquely.
Hum, yes. As evidenced by your perfectly reasonable, relaxed tone. Perhaps we need to shift some of your training from history to something more hands-on, more visceral.
Like natural science? Shallan asked, perking up.
Yasna tilted her head back. Shallan knelt down on a towel beside the pool, then reached down with her free hand, massaging the soap into her mistress's lush tresses. I was thinking philosophy, Yasna said. Shallan blinked.
Philosophy? What good is that?
Isn't it the art of saying nothing with as many words as possible?
Philosophy is an important field of study, Yasna said sternly, particularly if you're going to be involved in court politics. The nature of morality must be considered,
and preferably before one is exposed to situations where a moral decision is required.
Yes, Brightness. Though I fail to see how philosophy is more hands-on than history.
History, by definition, cannot be experienced directly. As it is happening, it is the present, and that is philosophy's realm.
That's just a matter of definition.
Yes, Jasnah said. All words have a tendency to be subject to how they are defined.
I suppose, Shallan said, leaning back, letting Jasnah dunk her hair to clean off the soap.
The princess began scrubbing her skin with mildly abrasive soap.
That was a particularly bland response, Shallan.
What happened to your wit?
Shallan glanced at the bench and its precious fabrile. After all this time, she had proven too weak to do what needed to be done.
My wit is in temporary hiatus, Brightness, she said. Pending review by its colleagues, Sincerity and Temerity.
Jasnah raised an eyebrow at her.
Shallan sat back on her heels, still kneeling on the towel.
How do you know what is right, Jasnah? If you don't listen to the devotaries, how do you decide?
That depends upon one's philosophy. What is most important to you?
I don't know. Can't you tell me?
No, Jasnah replied. If I gave you the answers, I'd be no better than the devotaries prescribing beliefs.
They aren't evil, Jasnah.
Except when they try to rule the world.
Shallan drew her lips into a thin line. The War of Loss had destroyed the hierocracy, shattering Voronism into the devotaries. That was the inevitable result of a religion trying to rule. The devotaries were to teach morals, not enforce them. Enforcement was for the Light Eyes.
You say you can't give me answers, Shallan said. But can't I ask for the advice of someone wise? Someone who's gone before?
Why write our philosophies, draw our conclusions, if not to influence others? You yourself told me that information is worthless unless we use it to make judgments.
Jasnah smiled, dunking her arms and washing off the soap.
Shallan caught a victorious glimmer in her eye.
She wasn't necessarily advocating ideas because she believed them. She just wanted to push Shallan.
It was infuriating.
How was Shallan to know what Jasnah really thought if she adopted conflicting points of view like this?
You act as if there were one answer, Jasnah said, gesturing to Shallan to fetch a towel and climbing from the pool.
A single, eternally perfect response.
Shallan hastily complied, bearing a large, fluffy towel.
Isn't that what philosophy is about? Finding the answers? Seeking the truth? The real meaning of things?
Toweling off, Jasnah raised an eyebrow at her.
What? Shallan asked, suddenly self-conscious.
I believe it is time for a field exercise, Jasnah said. Outside of the Palinaeum.
Now? Shallan asked.
It's so late.
I told you philosophy was a hands-on art. Jasnah said, wrapping the towel around herself, then reaching down and taking the soul caster out of its pouch. She slipped the chains around her fingers, securing the gemstones to the back of her hand.
I'll prove it to you.
Come, help me dress.
As a child, Shallan had relished those evenings when she'd been able to slip away into the gardens. When the blanket of darkness rested atop the grounds, they had seemed a different place entirely. In those shadows, she'd been able to imagine that the rock buds, shale bark, and trees were some foreign fauna. The scrapings of kremlings climbing out of cracks had become the footsteps of mysterious people from far-off lands. Large-eyed traders from Shinovar, a great shell rider from Cadrix, or a narrowboat sailor from the Pure Lake. She didn't have those same imaginings when walking Carbranth at night. Imagining dark wanderers in the night had once been an intriguing game, but here dark wanderers were likely to be real. Instead of becoming a mysterious, intriguing place at night, Carbranth seemed much the same to her, just more dangerous. Jasnah ignored the calls of rickshaw pullers and palanquin porters. She walked slowly in a beautiful dress of violet and gold, Shallan following in blue silk. Yasna hadn't taken time to have her hair done following her bath, and she wore it loose, cascading across her shoulders, almost scandalous in its freedom. They walked the Relinsa, the main thoroughfare that led down the hillside in switchbacks, connecting Conclave and Port. Despite the late hour, the roadway was crowded, and many of the men who walked here seemed to bear the night inside of them. They were gruffer, more shadowed of face. Shouts still rang through the city, but those carried the night in them too, measured by the roughness of their words and the sharpness of their tones. The steep, slanted hillside that formed the city was no less crowded with buildings than always, yet these too seemed to draw in the night. Blackened, like stones burned by a fire. Hollow remains. The bells still rang. In the darkness each ring was a tiny scream. They made the wind more present, a living thing that caused a chiming cacophony each time it passed. A breeze rose, and an avalanche of sound came tumbling across the Relinsa. Shallan nearly found herself ducking before it. "Brightness," Shallan said. "Shouldn't we call for a palanquin?" "A palanquin might inhibit the lesson." "I'll be all right learning that lesson during the day, if you wouldn't mind." Yasna stopped, looking off the Relinsa and toward a darker side street. "What do you think of that roadway, Shallan?"
"It doesn't look particularly appealing to me."
"And yet," Yasna said, "it is the most direct route from the Relinsa to the theater district."
"Is that where we're going?"
"We aren't going anywhere," Yasna said, taking off down the side street. "We are acting, pondering, and learning." Shallan followed nervously. The night swallowed them. Only the occasional light from late-night taverns and shops offered illumination. Yasna wore her black fingerless glove over her soulcaster, hiding the light of its gemstones. Shallan found herself creeping. Her slippered feet could feel every change in the ground underfoot, each pebble and crack. She looked about nervously as they passed a group of workers gathered around a tavern doorway. They were dark eyes, of course. In the night, that distinction seemed more profound.
"Brightness?" Shallan asked in a hushed tone.
"When we are young," Yasna said, "we want simple answers. There is no greater indication of youth, perhaps, than the desire for everything to be as it should, as it has ever been." Shallan frowned, still watching the men by the tavern over her shoulder.
"The older we grow," Yasna said, "the more we question. We begin to ask why, and yet we still want the answers to be simple. We assume that the people around us, adults, leaders, will have those answers. Whatever they give often satisfies us."
"I was never satisfied," Shallan said softly. "I wanted more."
"You were mature," Yasna said. "What you describe happens to most of us as we age. Indeed, it seems to me that aging, wisdom, and wondering are synonymous. The older we grow, the more likely we are to reject the simple answers, unless someone gets in our way and demands they be accepted regardless." Yasna's eyes narrowed. "You wonder why I reject the devotaries."
"I do."
"Most of them seek to stop the questions."
Yasna halted. Then she briefly pulled back her glove, using the light beneath to reveal the street around her. The gemstones on her hand, larger than bromes, blazed like torches, red, white, and gray.
"Is it wise to be showing your wealth like that, Brightness?" Shallan said, speaking very softly and glancing about her.
"No," Yasna said. "It is most certainly not, particularly not here. You see, this street has gained a particular reputation lately. On 3 separate occasions during the last 2 months, theatergoers who chose this route to the main road were accosted by footpads. In each case, the people were murdered. Shallan felt herself grow pale.
The city watch, Yasna said, has done nothing. Taravangian has sent them several pointed reprimands, but the captain of the watch is cousin to a very influential light eyes in the city, and Taravangian is not a terribly powerful king. Some suspect that there is more going on, that the footpads might be bribing the watch. The politics of it are irrelevant at the moment, for, as you can see, no members of the watch are guarding the place, despite its reputation. Yasna pulled her glove back on, plunging the roadway back into darkness. Shallan blinked, her eyes adjusting.
How foolish, Yasna said. Would you say it is for us to come here? Two undefended women wearing costly clothing and bearing riches.
Very foolish.
Yasna, can we go? Please? Whatever lesson you have in mind isn't worth this.
Yasna drew her lips into a line, then looked toward a narrow, darker alleyway off the road they were on. It was almost completely black, now that Yasna had replaced her glove.
You're at an interesting place in your life, Shallan, Yasna said, flexing her hand. You're old enough to wonder, to ask, to reject what is presented to you simply because it was presented to you. But you also cling to the idealism of youth. You feel there must be some single, all-defining truth. And you think that once you find it, all that once confused you will suddenly make sense.
Shallan wanted to argue, but Yasna's words were tellingly accurate. The terrible things Shallan had done, the terrible things she had planned to do, haunted her. Was it possible to do something horrible in the name of accomplishing something wonderful?
Yasna walked into the narrow alleyway.
Yasna, Shallan said, what are you doing?
This is philosophy in action, child, Yasna said. Come with me.
Shallan hesitated at the mouth of the alleyway, her heart thumping, her thoughts muddled. The wind blew and bells rang, like frozen raindrops shattering against the stones. In a moment of decision, she rushed after Yasna, preferring company, even in the dark, to being alone. The shrouded glimmer of the soulcaster was barely enough to light their way, and Shallan followed in Yasna's shadow.
Noise from behind.
Shallan turned with a start to see several dark forms crowding into the alley.
"Oh, Stormfather," she whispered.
"Why? Why was Yasna doing this?" Shaking, Shallan grabbed at Yasna's dress with her free hand. Other shadows were moving in front of them from the far side of the alley. They grew closer, grunting, splashing through foul, stagnant puddles. Chill water had already soaked Shallan's slippers. Yasna stopped moving. The frail light of her cloaked soulcaster reflected off metal in the hands of their stalkers. Swords or knives. These men meant murder. You didn't rob women like Shallan and Yasna, women with powerful connections, then leave them alive as witnesses. Men like these were not the gentlemen bandits of romantic stories. They lived each day knowing that if they were caught, they would be hanged. Paralyzed by fear, Shallan couldn't even scream.
"Stormfather! Stormfather! Stormfather!"
"And now," Yasna said, voice hard and grim. "The lesson." She whipped off her glove. The sudden light was nearly blinding. Shallan raised a hand against it, stumbling back against the alley wall. There were four men around them. Not the men from the tavern entrance, but others. Men she hadn't noticed watching them. She could see the knives now, and she could also see the murder in their eyes. Her scream finally broke free. The men grunted at the glare, but shoved their way forward. A thick-chested man with a dark beard came up to Yasna, weapon raised. She calmly reached her hand out, fingers splayed, and pressed it against his chest as he swung a knife. Shallan's breath caught in her throat. Yasna's hand sank into the man's skin, and he froze. A second later, he burned. No, he became fire. Transformed into flames in an eye blink. Rising around Yasna's hand, they formed the outline of a man with head thrown back and mouth open,
For just a moment, the blaze of the man's death outshone Yasna's gemstones. Shallan's scream trailed off. The figure of flames was strangely beautiful. It was gone in a moment, the fire dissipating into the night air, leaving an orange afterimage in Shallan's eyes. The other three men began to curse, scrambling away, tripping over one another in their panic. One fell. Yasna turned casually, brushing his shoulder with her fingers as he struggled to his knees. He became crystal, a figure of pure, flawless quartz, his clothing transformed along with him. The diamond in Yasna's soul caster faded, but there was still plenty of stormlight left to send rainbow sparkles through the transformed corpse. The other two men fled in opposite directions. Yasna took a deep breath, closing her eyes, lifting her hand above her head. Shallan held her safe hand to her breast, stunned, confused, terrified. Stormlight shot from Yasna's hand like twin bolts of lightning, symmetrical. One struck each of the footpads and they popped, puffing into smoke. Their empty clothing dropped to the ground. With a sharp snap, the smokestone crystal on Yasna's soul caster cracked, its light vanishing, leaving her with just the diamond and the ruby. The remains of the two footpads rose into the air, small billows of greasy vapor. Yasna opened her eyes, looking eerily calm. She tugged her glove back on, using her safe hand to hold it against her stomach and sliding her free hand fingers in. Then she calmly walked back the way they had come. She left the crystal corpse kneeling with hand upraised, frozen forever. Shallan pried herself off the wall and hastened after Yasna, sickened and amazed. Ardents were forbidden to use their soul casters on people. They rarely even used them in front of others. And how had Yasna struck down two men at a distance? From everything Shallan had read, what little there was to find, soul casting required physical contact. Too overwhelmed to demand answers, she stood silent, free hand held to the side of her head, trying to control her trembling and her gasping breaths, as Yasna called for a palanquin. One came eventually, and the two women climbed in. The bearers carried them toward the Relinsa, their steps jostling Shallan and Yasna, who sat across from one another in the palanquin. Yasna idly popped the broken smokestone from her soul caster, then tucked it into a pocket. It could be sold to a gemsmith, who could cut smaller gemstones from the salvaged pieces. "That was horrible," Shallan finally said, hand still held to her breast. "It was one of the most awful things I've ever experienced. You killed four men." "Four men who were planning to beat, rob, kill, and possibly rape us."
"You tempted them into coming for us."
"Did I force them to commit any crimes?"
"You showed off your gemstones."
"Can a woman not walk with her possessions down the street of a city?"
"At night?" Shallan asked. "Through a rough area displaying wealth? You all but asked for what happened."
"Does that make it right?" Yasna said, leaning forward. "Do you condone what the men were planning to do?"
"Of course not. But that doesn't make what you did right either."
"And yet those men are off the street. The people of this city are that much safer. The issue that Taravangian has been so worried about has been solved, and no more theatergoers will fall to those thugs." "How many lives did I just save?"
"I know how many you just took," Shallan said, "and through the power of something that should be holy.
Philosophy in action. An important lesson for you."
"You did all this just to prove a point," Shallan said softly. "You did this to prove to me that you could. Damnation, Yasna, how could you do something like that?"
Yasna didn't reply. Shallan stared at the woman, searching for emotion in those expressionless eyes.
"Stormfather, did I ever really know this woman? Who is she, really?"
Yasna leaned back, watching the city pass. "I did not do this just to prove a point, child.
I have been feeling for some time that I took advantage of His Majesty's hospitality. He doesn't realize how much trouble he could face for allying himself with me. Besides, men like those. There was something in her voice, an edge Shallan had never heard before. What was done to you? Shallan wondered with horror. And who did it? Regardless, Yasna continued, tonight's actions came about because I chose this path. Not because of anything I felt you needed to see. However, the opportunity also presented a chance for instruction, for questions. Am I a monster, or am I a hero? Did I just slaughter 4 men, or did I stop 4 murderers from walking the streets? Does one deserve to have evil done to her by consequence of putting herself where evil can reach her? Did I have a right to defend myself? Or was I just looking for an excuse to end lives?
I don't know, Shallan whispered.
You will spend the next week researching it and thinking on it. If you wish to be a scholar, a true scholar who changes the world, then you will need to face questions like this. There will be times when you must make decisions that churn your stomach, Shallan Devar. I'll have you ready to make those decisions. Yasna fell silent, looking out the side as the palanquin bearers marched them up the conclave. Too troubled to say more, Shallan suffered the rest of the trip in silence. She followed Yasna through the hushed hallways to their rooms, passing scholars on their way to the Palinaeum for some midnight study. Inside their rooms, Shallan helped Yasna undress, though she hated touching the woman. She shouldn't have felt that way. The men Yasna had killed were terrible creatures, and she had little doubt that they would have killed her. But it wasn't the act itself so much as the cold callousness of it that bothered her.